Thanks for listening to this Arrow FM podcast, brought to you with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Kia ora, you're listening to Film Talks On Air. I'm your host, Jane Ross, and I am delighted to be talking to Rob Sarkis today. Kia ora, Rob.
Kia ora, Jane.
How are you today?
I'm very fine today. Looking forward to our chat.
Me too. I am absolutely thrilled that you are going to be part of the Wairarapa Film Festival for 2025, and especially that it is part of the Annie Collins retrospective that we're presenting. I love Annie. I love her work, and it's a delight that I can celebrate her at the Regent Three Cinemas in Masterton. Fun fact, Annie grew up in a bakery, a family bakery called Magnet Bakery, that just happened to be right next door to Regent Three Cinemas in Masterton. So her view every day was of the cinema.
That's brilliant. Second fun fact is that when Annie Collins is editing, she bakes for her director. So we have incredible, and she's an excellent baker. Obviously, it's in the genes. And so she has, there's a whole selection of mostly sweet treats that go with our coffee in the morning and in the afternoon. So anyone who's made a film with Annie has tasted her baking, and it is Masterton sublime.
I am delighted to hear that. You know, I met Annie last year when she came to the film festival, and it was a presentation of Vincent Ward's, a retrospective of his films. And Annie came with her nephew also to a film called Mari Mari that she was editing, and her nephew is a baker. So it carries on.
There's actually a, you know, there is a bit of a metaphor there in terms of the kind of care that you need to put into making a cake, making a film. It's a recipe. In both cases, it's a recipe that can fail. And in both cases, I think you really can feel the love, the care, the craft that goes in from, you know, from the maker. In fact, most of us who are making independent films in New Zealand, we're like, I don't know, bespoke bakers. You know, we're not, we're not your supermarket tip top brand. You know, we're something else, something you'd get at a small, hopefully lovely bakery. And I think that that sort of artisan, it's artisan bakery and artisan films, and that's definitely the sort of productions that that Annie always gets involved in.
Wonderful metaphor. I would love to know some more about your entry into working in the New Zealand film industry. How did you get started?
I basically started when I was a kid. I've been making films, short films, when I was a kid, since I was 10, 11, entering into the older listeners will remember, some older listeners will remember the Spot On Film Competition.
Fabulous.
Way back in the 80s, I would diligently enter a film in every year. And you know, that was at a time when television was really exciting. To be honest, for me, more exciting than film. Film seemed like it was dying. Cinemas were closing down and no one was going
back in the 80s.
Or early 80s, at least, before they, you know, reinvented themselves into multiplexes. And but television was the thing. And back in Dunedin, where I grew up, there was only one channel for quite a lot of my childhood. On a Sunday night, you pretty much had the whole country, you know, watching this one program, Spot On, which meant that if you made the winning film as a kid, your film could be seen by a million people. And that just seemed magical to me, crazy magical, that that I could shoot something on this little, you know, literally wind up 8mm camera, and what I made could be seen by a million people. That was like, wow.
Did you enter and look, tell me like the pathway for you entering?
I I don't know, maybe I was a slow learner. I just kept entering and then and losing or just not getting anywhere. And then as I went through high school, I kept on entering, and I guess I got better at what I was doing. It was definitely an advantage doing a lot of my learning while I was, you know, film learning while I was very young, because, you know, you can excuse a kid, where it's harder to excuse an adult if they make a bad film. Eventually, I think when I was in my sixth form year, whatever that converts into now, I got runner up, which was pretty exciting. And then I won the competition when I was in my seventh form, and you know, really, I suppose that just gave me the validation I needed to, if I needed any, to be honest, but the validation that was useful to, you know, to keep going, and then made films through university, and short films through university and beyond, until I made my first feature, Scarfies, when I was about 30.
So you were a Scarfie yourself?
Yeah, well, I was from Dunedin, so I was a Scarfie, but not a, I wouldn't say I was a bona fide Scarfie. I think I actually missed out on, you know, a lot of that experience that many others have of basically leaving home and coming down to Dunedin. You know, for some of the time when I was a student, I was at home, because I was also trying to be a filmmaker, and that's expensive. So, you know, stay with the folks for as long as you can. let them help fund the film through feeding me. But actually, that probably gave me, it probably meant that I was observing the lifestyle more than living it. And I think, you know, when you talk to a lot of writers and artists, they tend to be the observers, you know. Mm-hmm. We're not necessarily all kind of big party animals. Generally, you're the one, or I can only speak for myself, I'm the one that will be, you know, kind of, you know, standing back a bit and just watching what's going on, taking in the vibe. And I was certainly doing that when I was at university. Well, I guess I was, because I was able to, you know, translate some of that experience alongside my brother Duncan, of course, who was the co-writer, into a pretty iconic what's become a pretty iconic feature film for Dunedin anyway.
Oh, it absolutely is. Even in recent years, I was talking to somebody who teaches film at Otago University, and he said to me, I cannot explain what the feeling was like to be sitting in Regent in the Octagon and seeing Scarfies come on the big screen, and the enormous sense of pride that I felt in seeing myself reflected onto that screen, that kind of identity, was really, really, really powerful. So yes.
Yeah, you could feel, you could definitely feel that in the room. And I don't know, what does it say? It says something about the, you know, the power of that big screen, because, you know, I think lots of filmmakers, especially when they go to smaller places to, you know, to make films for the first time, they have something of that experience. It's like when we see ourselves on the screen, we're somehow validated, because actually we're so used to seeing other people, generally Americans, to be honest, on that big screen. And so when we see ourselves, a reflection of ourselves, or, you know, communities that we recognize, it almost makes them, it's a validation. It's like, oh, it's here, we've arrived, we're here. We, yeah, mean something too. And you know, I think that's one of the things that's so important about us telling New Zealand story, or New Zealand filmmakers telling New Zealand stories, because it's important for all of us to have that available. You know, otherwise, if it's just if you look on Netflix, it's very rare to be able to see a New Zealand story. Occasionally, there might be an old Taika Waititi film, or obviously, you know, Peter Jackson epic, and that's fantastic, but very little else. It's really hard to find. And I think these, I think that we, in fact, it's the value of the sort of festival that you're running, Jane, and other festivals around the country, is to, you know, put ourselves up on the big screen, or at least provide that outlet, you know, alongside films from all over the world, of course.
Yes, Yes, we have amazing storytellers in this country and amazing stories to be told. I'm really interested in the fact that you've made several films set in Dunedin or Otago Southland, and I'm wondering what drew you particularly to wanting to create films set in the place that you come from.
Authenticity.
Yeah.
I guess I knew that I couldn't with my short films, I was sort of I didn't really set them anywhere, and quite intentionally, I didn't want them to feel like New Zealand films particularly, which seems a strange thing for a New Zealand filmmaker to say, but maybe some people will get that, some form of escapism or something. But when I sort of started to look towards feature films, what I knew is that you can't really hide in a feature film. You put a version of yourself at whatever age and stage you're at up there on the big screen, because you know you're making them in a fast and furious way. You're making a lot of instinctual decisions. No matter how well planned you are, and I think it really shows when you don't know that world, or at least it really shows when you do know that world, because you almost subconsciously can include details that other people from that world can recognize. And even people who aren't from that world, who weren't, say, Scarfies, you know, people watching the film or any film you make, you know, who are international, they can sort of feel that it is, or what I hope is they can feel that my films are kind of imbued, I suppose, with a sense of place, with an authenticity. You can sort of make that up. Of course, lots of people do. You can, I suppose, you know, you literally could have set Scarfies anywhere, really, in any student town, probably anywhere in the world. Mm. And in terms of the story. But setting it in Dunedin with this filmmaker, making it with my knowledge of that place and of the people and of the, you know, the vibe, I suppose, of that place, sort of just gives it something else, its own secret sauce.
Yeah.
It makes it specific. And what I really love when I go to see other people's movies is when I'm seeing the world through someone else's eyes. So I want to see their world. I want something specific. So I guess I just try to do that myself. An example of just sort of knowing the world really well is that we had a wardrobe designer, costume designer, actually, you're supposed to say nowadays, on Scarfies, amazing costume designer called Amanda Neal. This was her first job as a senior costume designer, as the costume designer on a feature film, Scarfies. She sort of came to me with a whole bunch of ideas of what the characters should be wearing, and they were all fantastic. But I said to her, and they all looked great, but I knew as soon as I saw her initial designs that they were wrong. So I said, in Dunedin, we don't do layers.
No.
Well, we didn't in the 80s, right?
No.
We just, like, so I want big, dumpy jerseys. And I knew that because I'd lived that, you know.
Yeah.
I had a childhood freezing sometimes, you know, sitting on the Conray heater with my, you know, with your legs going a little bit, kind of a little bit red underneath, where they're getting too much heat. and you know, wearing those big dumpy jerseys. In fact, I'm wearing one right now, and in Wellington. And I just knew something that I wouldn't have known had the film been set somewhere else. And I would have gone with, you know, the sort of typical, and I would say probably more Auckland layered look. Yeah, you know, no, there's no point wearing layers in midwinter Dunedin, because you're just going to be cold all day. Just,
yes.
You know,
yeah.
If you're going to be cold with one jersey, we'll put on a second jersey. If that's layers, but it's not layers you can see. So that's what she did. And that's just a small example of something very specific that really only comes out of knowledge of a place.
Yeah, it is of its place. And speaking of places, I mean, people still look for that house. I mean, we all know, if you've been to Dunedin, if you've been a student in Dunedin, you know that the housing stock for students isn't great, but that house is so iconic, and the people arrive in Dunedin and they go looking for it. There's something about that place.
Yeah, there is something about that place. I think they did very well out of the film. We rented it off them for a year. In fact, I knew I wanted to make the film in 1998 is when we shot it, and we didn't have the funding at the beginning of 1998, but we did have the script. So myself and Lisa, the producer, just decided we'd rent the house so that if we did get the money, we'd rent it out ourselves and then sublet it to some students who were there under the agreement that we could kick them out at any point. and that's exactly what we did, you know. So there's how to make a film, just rent the house and then you'll end up making the film.
That's fantastic. That's something I didn't know. I love your films, and so does Annie. Annie talks so highly of working with you. And, I mean, for somebody who has worked as an editor in the industry for over 50 years, it wasn't easy when I said to her, I want you to choose 4 feature films to screen as part of your retrospective, and just absolutely delighted that she chose Out of the Blue. For anyone that doesn't know about this film, please tell us about Out of the Blue.
Well, Out of the Blue is based on the Arimawana massacre, which prior to Christchurch was the biggest mass murder, I guess, of New Zealanders on New Zealand soil. 13 people were killed by a lone gunman at a time when this sort of thing just simply didn't happen in New Zealand. I was in Dunedin at the time, and I do remember seeing the headline of the Sydney Morning Herald the day after, and the headline was "The Day New Zealand Lost Its Innocence."
Yes,
I think we all felt that all over again when the mosque shootings happened, but this Arimawana was the first time, and I was shown a book by my producer who was interested in optioning it and perhaps developing a film. The book was written by Bill O'Brien, a policeman who had been very involved with the families in Arimawana during and probably more important during the aftermath of it all. And I read the book, and which had it was very well written, but it did have you know, it's quite a strong sort of police focus, I suppose. But what I felt that I could see in a potential film translation was a story about a community pulling together and surviving together. And you know, I went down to Dunedin with Graham Tetley, who passed quite a few years ago now, just after the Christchurch earthquake, actually. I went down to Dunedin with Graham, and we rented a crib. Actually arranged by the writer of the book. And the crib that we rented was a crib of this old lady who I think was in a home at that point, so she wasn't in the crib. And we were in this crib just there to really chat to locals and get a feel for the place and try and figure out what this potential film might be. And I did know something of her story, this old lady. And I, at one point on the very first night, I pointed to her photo, which was still up in the crib, and I said to Graham, I think she's one of the stars of our film.
Oh, wow. What inspired
because I was aware of her story. She actually I won't give too much away for those who haven't seen the film, but she won a George Medal for her heroism. I guess she was an unlikely hero, being in her must have been late 70s or older at the time when this happened. And I just didn't feel like I'd seen a movie about a mass shooting that had an old lady as one of its heroes. And she, you know, it sort of, I guess she represented the community. There are others in the film also who represent the community, including the police. So the idea of community was a way of folding everyone into the story, and it gave us an angle on how to treat the police story, because it meant that the police story, because of course, you know, the police came in and had to try and find the guy, as you'd expect in the situation. But the thing that made that story distinctive was that the police were members of this community too. So when they saw people who had been shot, they were seeing their friends and neighbours, which is very different from what we think of as an American version of this sort of story, where, you know, the police come in and it's just, you know, it's just sort of bodies on the road, if you like. It's very different if you know those people. So that gave us our frame, I suppose, and we spoke to a lot of people from the community. I feel like we almost spoke to everyone in the community. You know, not everyone was supportive of it, but most were quietly supportive, or we sort of earned their trust over time as they sort of saw that we were genuine in what we were trying to do. We weren't trying to be in any way exploitative of the story, of the tragedy.
I am aware that you had meetings with the community to discuss these concerns.
We had public meetings, but we had many, many private meetings. Mm. You know, I challenged her. I said, people, if you want to come and see me, we were literally staying in that crib I was telling you about before.
Yeah.
And people did come, and in some cases, Chiquita Holden here, the daughter of Gary Holden, her father, who was shot. She came and you know, challenged me to my face. You know, she said, "What right do you have to tell this story?" Which is a really interesting question, and it's not one that you can really give an answer to, because from her point of view, I could understand her perspective. But some stories do enter the public domain. They become our stories because they're so big. You know, those of us who were around at the time remember this. It affected us. Mm-hmm. It becomes a New Zealand story. I believe that we should be prepared to tell these stories. You know, we should tell the feel good stories, but I think we should also tell some of the stories that I suppose hold a mirror up to the darker side of what it is to be, what it is to live in New Zealand. Our isolation, the rampant mental illness in communities big and small, and you know, the way we do, like everyone anywhere, I guess, you tend to sort of judge the outsiders in your community, and you know, there was a little bit of that going on in Arawana, that didn't cause this event. No one deserved to be shot, obviously, but didn't help. You know, even in these small communities that we always think of as close-knit, you can have people who are very, very alone
and vulnerable, and
yeah,
and actually also bullied. And I'm not going to say too much more about that, because I think the whole story around telling the story is so fascinating, and there's so many parts of it to discuss that I will actively encourage people to come to the screening, because they'll have the chance to talk with you and Annie. After the film, we'll have a dedicated film talk with the audience, where people will have the opportunity to get to know more about, you know, the story behind the story, which is really a great opportunity for people to understand this better. and to understand our stories and how we tell our stories better. So that screening is going to be on Sunday, the 25th of May, and at Regent Three Cinemas. We're looking at a 1:15 screening followed by the Q&A with you and Annie, and I'm so looking forward to that. I'm also really looking forward to seeing what you're currently working on, which is a story about Pike River. Please tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I guess the you can feel some of the DNA of Pike River in Arowana. I mean, Pike River is also a story about a community trying to survive a tragic event. And,
yes.
And Pike River's case, it doesn't really focus on the. It includes, but it doesn't really focus on the explosion. It's more about the aftermath of that explosion. Or actually, there were several explosions, and it explores both how the families were treated by those in power, how they were sometimes, often actually, just lied to. And promised things that never happened, but also, and this is sort of why I wanted to make the film. It felt like an inspiring story about how it's possible to fight back, how it's possible for David to fight Goliath,
yes.
and get somewhere. You know, I don't know if you ever quite win, because it depends how you define winning, but definitely become empowered is one of the things. You know, it's these sorts of stories are often when they go well, they chart a journey from, I guess you'd say, victimhood to empowerment, and it sort of shows that when people care about something, when there's a deep wrong or a series of deep wrongs, in the case of Pike River, that have been done, and people really care about that and can see that it's obviously wrong and are prepared to stand up, put themselves on the line and fight back, that can yield results. And it was incredibly inspiring to me to meet the Pike River families and see how they bonded together, really, to become one family versus some of the most powerful forces in the country, which includes big business, the government, the police, the justice system. It is an extraordinary story, and we're soon to announce when the international premiere will be of that film,
fabulous.
And it will release nationwide in New Zealand later this year.
I am so.
Oh, it stars Robin Mell. Did I say we had some great?
No,
actors,
but I know you've got some really, really fabulous people starring and acting in this film. Robin Malcolm being one of them. Who else?
Melanie Linsky.
Exciting.
So we bring Robin and Melanie together as sort of the two representing two women. It's very much a female story, actually. This one, it's about sort of two women that drive everything. Two middle-aged women. It's great. It's written by Fiona Samuel, who's really that's very much in her wheelhouse. Kind of, you know, female empowerment stories, and it also stars Lucy Lawless, who plays Helen Kelly, who's some of your listeners will know as a pretty amazing, very amazing woman in herself, in the union scene.
An incredible woman, yes. And I know that she was, while fighting cancer, was supporting families at Pike River, and that's an incredible story in itself. It has been absolutely wonderful to take time to talk with you today, Rob, and I'm really looking forward to welcoming you to the Wairarapa Film Festival. I'm excited that you're part of the Annie Collins retrospective and that we get to celebrate Annie at the same time that we celebrate you.
I'm excited to celebrate Annie as well. A lot of people don't think about the importance of the editor in the making of films. You know, we shine a light on the actors, obviously. We also have a light shone on the director, who is at the heart of a film production. But and sometimes and the writer as well, because we're usually aware that someone had to had to write what we're seeing, the architect, I suppose, the architect of the film, the blueprint writer, the blueprint drawer. But I think because the editor is, it's not really people. A lot of people don't really understand what they do, and what they do is they retell the story. They cut it all up and add the music and create the kind of the rhythms of the film. You know, they're sort of like a composer, I suppose, but a composer of imagery. And they're working alongside the director, but the editor you choose to work with is very much defines the feel of the film. You know, if I'd made Out of the Blue with a different editor, it would have still been a Rob Sarkis film, but it would be very much a different film from the film that is. So I'm delighted to sort of celebrate, you know, any of the unsung heroes of New Zealand film. And, you know, Annie just has a huge raft of films that she has edited with incredible passion. And, it's back. We're heading back to the baker analogy from the beginning. You know, it's all done with love and care. And boy, can you tell.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, well, ngā mihi nui ki a koe, Rob. You have a wonderful, wonderful weekend ahead. And we welcome you to the film festival in May. Speak soon.